all wrapped up with the best music mix on Sports Saturday, 3 till 6 with me, Paul Davis, on BCFM 93.2, DAB and online.
BCFM Sports Saturday.
The black community is being taught lies by their leaders, just like we're being taught lies by our leaders. And we're all being pitted against each other for no reason whatsoever than so that we can be controlled more easily by the slave masters.
Welcome back to BCFM's Politics Show with Old Labour Oxford economist Martin Summers and me, Tony Gosling. With each terror attack, MI5 have been growing richer and more powerful. Is there any incentive for them to stop the next one? Horrifying news slipped quietly out last weekend from MI5 that they could have prevented the Manchester Arena terror attack, since they've been tracking and following the alleged bomber Salman Abedi for years. And to add mischievousness to mass murder, his father Ramadan was a long-time agent of MI6. If this sounds familiar, then there's Michael Adebolajo, Michael Adebowale, who killed British soldier in 2013 Ree Rigby. They were sprung from a Kenyan jail and brought to London specially by MI6. Thanks, guys. In March this year, Khalid Massoud drove over Westminster Bridge to attack the Houses of Parliament. He was on MI5's books for previous two. Days before the general election, in June, Kurram Butt and Rashid Redouane carry out the London Bridge attacks. Both were close to the top of MI5's terror watch list, but even appeared on a Channel 4 programme as himself, a dangerous radicalised Muslim. And all of the above had been reported by members of the public to MI5's anti-terror hotline. So are MI5 organising terrorist attacks or just watching them as they happen, then hoping to get more legal powers like the Snoopers Charter, which they've just got from Theresa May, and more public money? What can we do when terror attacks become milk and honey to MI5? One man who thinks heads should roll at the security service is Graham Fawkes, who lost his son David in the 7/7 London bombings. Not only does he want to see unaccountable MI5 chiefs lose their job, he wants to take Britain's entire anti-terror apparatus back to the drawing board. Bastion of the free press also tonight, the USA wants restrictions on Russia Today's Washington Bureau and RT America. When it comes to propaganda, they can satellite dish it out, but they can't take it. Also, have you wondered where all the money's gone? New estimates put the cost of the war on terror at $5.6 trillion. Plus, also, Saudi Arabia's Crown Prince Mohammed bin Salman is kidnapped. The Lebanese Prime Minister, Saab Hariri, at least it seems this week, has forced him to resign on TV, and where he said that he'd been threatened with execution. Getting ready for an epic war with Iran, perhaps? But does he realise he's just dancing to the Confederate General Albert Pike's tune from 1875? And we'll have a look at that Albert Pike letter, which predicts three world wars, at the end of the show today. But Martin, let's start by having a look at the MI5 reports that MI5 could have stopped the Manchester Arena terror attacks. This is MI5 themselves telling us this.
Well, I think there are obviously questions about whether they could have stopped it, but there are even bigger questions about whether they're actually involved, MI5 and MI6. Don't forget, particularly the Manchester Arena attack, that was a professionally made bomb. The father of the bomber was an Islamic fighting group activist from Libya who was also working closely with MI6. And of course, MI6 have been working with the Islamic fighting groups since the 1990s, when the David Shaler and Annie Machon blew the whistle on the fact that the Islamic Fighting Group was being given...
Oh, that's that guy that thinks he's Jesus.
Yes, but of course Annie Machon doesn't think she's Jesus. She was also involved. The fact is that the Islamic Fighting Group, regardless of their information, I think it's well known that the Islamic Fighting Group provided most of the activists who went to fight in Afghanistan in the 1980s. In fact, Benghazi in Tripoli and Benghazi were the place, and Benghazi more than Tripoli provided by far the most number of people who were funneled into Afghanistan, anyway, having been trained and directed by our own
security
forces.
Let's get back to Manchester for a minute.
So that's the point I'm making.
On Sunday Times last week is saying that the review had triggered deep concerns within the intelligence community that the attack, the deadliest in Britain since the 2005 London bombings, could have been stopped. MI5 Director General Andrew Parker is said to be in danger of losing his job.
Well, that's the very least you could say. I suspect also, don't forget that the bomber's father is in Libya. He's under arrest by one of the militias in various parts of Libya. He was definitely a member of the Libyan Islamic Fighting Group and also worked closely with MI6. MI6 and the Libyan Islamic Fighting Group have got an intimate relationship going back decades. The Islamic Fighting Group is the Libyan version of Al-Qaeda, and they've got an intimate relationship with our security forces. That's what people have got to recognise. These people didn't arise from nowhere.
No, I've been talking
they've been armed and trained by our own tax money.
I was talking about the killers of Lee Rigby, both brought into Britain by MI6 specially. I mean, who would say to kill him? I mean, the Kenyan secret services over there said to MI6 along secure channels when Michael Adebalajo and Michael Adebowale were brought to Britain, they said, are you sure you really want these guys back? They're crazy.
Now, what tends to happen in these circumstances is that MI5, MI6, the security services will say, well, of course, some people, we allow them to operate so that we can watch what they do, so that we can then get more information. Now, I would
argue... in this specific case of the Manchester attack, MI5 officials received at least two items of intelligence about the bomber that indicated he posed a serious threat before he went on to kill concertgoers at the Ariana Grande concert.
I think that that's just the tip of the iceberg. As I've just suggested to you, the Islamic Fighting Group, which has a base in Manchester and has had a base in Manchester since the 1980s, Britain was called at one stage by the French police, Londonistan and so all the rest of it, because Operation Cyclone's headquarters were in Britain. And that was when Al-Qaeda was set up by the Western Intelligence Services. Nobody disputes this. It was set up by the Western Intelligence Services, MI6 as the lead agency, and therefore we had loads of Libyans living in Manchester, exiles from Libya, working closely with our intelligence services, even though they were Al-Qaeda. That's the facts.
What about these three attacks in the run-up to the general election this year, 22nd of March... Khalid Massoud being followed by MI5 on the Manchester attack we just heard about, Salman Abedi and also Karan Butt in the London Bridge attack, is even on television telling the world that he's a crazy Islamic extremist on Channel 4.
Well, the suspicion has to be that these attacks were all up in the run-up to the general election because they were linked to the general election, which is what you expect if it is some kind of Gladio-style structure inside the security services who are behind it all.
There was that horrific attack in Barcelona just before they had their vote over there, the referendum vote.
Indeed. Now, the point is that we're not just randomly speculating here. It is a fact that the Libyan Islamic Fighting Group, which is Al-Qaeda Libya, has intimate relations with MI6 going back decades. They've been operating together for years. They were trained in bomb making, assassination, etc., with our taxes, and there's no dispute about that. What we're told is these structures, which we set up in the 1980s under Operation Cyclone, suddenly went rogue. I don't believe that. I believe that modern Islamic terrorism is still being orchestrated by Western intelligence services. That's what the Russian general staff believe.
Now,
and they're right.
I suppose the sharp end of all of this are the families of those who've lost their lives here in Britain and the other people who've been involved in these attacks.
Well, of course, and eventually people start to wise up when so many, when all of this stuff gradually creeps out. You know, this show has always been we will examine these kind of things where the mainstream fears to tread, because we know the history of Gladio. We know the history of the Western intelligence services. They definitely were involved in terrorism in Italy, Belgium, and other places in Europe, and so were definitely set up Al Qaeda. They themselves admit that they set up Al Qaeda. They don't dispute it.
Before we hear from Graham Fawkes, just explain what you think should have happened after the 7/7 London bombings, because both I and he have said that there should have been a public inquiry. There never has been, and Tony Blair put a stop to it. He said, in fact, a public inquiry would be a ludicrous diversion.
Well, I'm not opposed to public inquiries, but the police should have been the lead agency, and they should have investigated the intelligence services and the Israelis, who had a warning. The Israelis definitely had a warning of the attack. If I was the head of the Metropolitan Police, I'd seal off the embassy, cut off the electricity and water, and say, right, we want to know about your warning.
Anyway, for those that lost their lives, their main objective is to try and get the system changed so that this doesn't keep repeating itself, where we keep hearing time after time after time, oh, sorry, we should have done better. This is Graham Fawkes, who I spoke to earlier this week, who lives up in the Manchester area and who lost his son David in the July 7th London bombings.
My name's Graham Fawkes. I live just outside Manchester, and the London bombings, the so-called 7/7 bombings in July 2005, my son David, who was 22 and travelling for the first time on his own, stood next to the leader of the four London bombers, Mohammed Sadiq Khan, at Edgware Road train when the bomb sent off and David was killed.
I mean, I know it must be awful to keep going through this and talking to people about it, Graham. Can you just tell us what the subsequent week was like for you?
The London bombs were a Thursday, and we had no contact from anybody in authority, the police or anybody, for nearly a week, 6.5 days. And then on the following Wednesday evening, at 6:20, time I'll never forget, we had a phone call to confirm that David had been identified as one of those who had been killed.
But that intervening time, you must have been so desperately worried. Did you feel that the authorities were doing enough to make sure that people were informed as to what was going on?
Well, we didn't know what the authorities were doing because we had no contact with them. We were sat at home reading newspapers, watching the news bulletins, and desperately phoning David and getting no response. And as time went on, you don't come to terms with it, but keep going through your mind is this feeling that no news is good news. And we knew that in that week from the media that there were 9 people who were in comas, seriously injured but unidentified. So we spent a lot of time on the phone to various hospitals trying to find out what the people in the, well, first of all, did the hospital have any of these 9 people, trying to find out the hospitals where they were, and then trying to somehow get information from them in the hope that it might be David and we'd have travelled down to London. But as it happens, no news is good news. It's just simply not true.
Okay, so what about once you discovered that your son had died, how did you deal with the authorities over that? Or did you get a chance to identify him, that sort of thing?
Well, the police family liaison office service kicked in. And I have to say, the two police officers from Greater Manchester that we dealt with, Jack and Laura, were the two kindest and most helpful human beings on the planet. They were absolutely superb. As I said, it was the Wednesday, 6:20, the following Wednesday evening, we were told. The police officers came around immediately and sat with us. And we had a very difficult emotional time. And then on the Sunday, the police officers drove us down to London to the temporary mortuary. As I said, David was stood next to the bomb when it went off. So the police and the people in the mortuary were very keen that Janet and I didn't look at David. And they spent over 40 minutes trying to persuade us not to. But as a father and a parent, you have to. So we did view David, yes. And that was a very, very difficult time.
And so you were actually able to positively identify him?
From the people I know in London, we all did. As a parent, you have to. And I'm sure that if it was a spouse or your parent, you would have to well. I can't believe that anybody wouldn't do. And I also believe that's been the case in the Manchester attack as well.
Well, what about the process of the inquest? Because that took a while to even get started, didn't it?
Yes, it was 4 years, and the reason for the delay was 2 weeks after July the 5th. There was another attack in London which failed. They were then arrested, captured, held in custody, and there was a delay of about a year. And then there was a trial, and towards the end of the trial, it collapsed. So they were held in custody, and the trial had to be reheld. And that whole delay took over 2 years. And because they were associated with 7-7, we couldn't have the inquest because it could have influenced the jury and affected the trial. So the inquest was actually delayed for 4 years.
Now, there are some people that say, including some lawyers, that actually it should have been a public inquiry, not an inquest, because an inquest is actually specifically designed for a single specific death, suspicious death, and this wasn't that. It was something like 52, 56 people died.
52 people died. In fact, we lobbied very hard for it to be a public inquiry. The reason for that was we discovered in that, because of this, the trial I've just talked about, and also the media were excellent in discovering that the four bombers were well known to the security service, both to MI6, MI5, names I'm only used to in James Bond films, and with the Metropolitan Police, West Yorkshire Police, and some other anti-terrorist act and bomb plots. And because they knew about Sadiq Khan, and Sadiq Khan and his three colleagues had got through, we felt that that should be examined in a very deep and detailed way, that, as you're quite right, an inquest is not set up to do. We lobbied very, very hard for that, and we were absolutely refused that that should happen.
Sorry. This is not the correct legal procedure, so how did they manage to convince you to do an inquest, not a public inquiry?
They didn't convince us, they just said no. They were as blunt as that.
Is this the Home Office we're talking about? Who's this?
Yeah, that was the... John Reid was the Home Secretary at the time, and John Reid just said no. And he insisted, well, not insisted, he just said, and it therefore happened, that it would be an inquest. And what happened was that at the inquest, the scope of the inquest was broadened to include preventability, and that was their SOP to us over the public inquiry.
Okay, so to what extent did they prove that this was a preventable attack? Because at the time, I mean, I can remember very well the announcements in the media that the London bombers were what they call clean skins, in other words, that they had no intelligence on them before whatsoever.
Well, there's a couple of points there, Tony. One is the government completely denied that the phrase clean skins had been used. The security services said they'd never used that phrase, and the police said they'd never used that phrase. So that in itself became a controversial point. But what happened at the inquest was, for the first time, the chief of staff of MI5 gave evidence. And when it was pointed out to him that MI5 had been watching Sadiq Khan for a number of years, West Yorkshire Police had been watching him for a number of years, and in 2004, the Metropolitan Police and MI5 had been watching Sadiq Khan because he was involved in the Omar Khayyam fertilizer bomb, which you may remember. Omar Khayyam was sentenced to life. He had 650 kilos of fertilizer, and Sadiq Khan was involved in that. So at the inquest, the chief of staff was asked a very simple question. If all the dots had been joined up, would 7-7 have been prevented? And his exact words were that it may well have been the case that 7-7 would have been prevented. I was sat in the courtroom probably 20 feet away from him when he said it, and I was so shocked I couldn't move, because I actually wanted to get up and hit him, which is quite a silly thing to say, really. But I was so angry that he very calmly sat there and admitted that, as I said, if all the dots had been joined up, it may well have been prevented.
Now, I mean, MI5 seemed to be getting some special treatment when it comes to the law. In other words, someone can give evidence in this inquest anonymously from behind a screen, I think it was.
The chief of staff gave evidence in open court. It wasn't behind the screen. worrying. I can see, in my mind's eye now, I can see him very clearly. What happened at the setup for the inquest, the court that was used is actually quite small, and there was, within the grounds of the Royal Courts of Justice, a huge marquee was set up, and there was a live camera feed from inside the court to this marquee, and that's where the press and members of the public could sit. And that live, when the Chief of Staff of the Men of Fabricating Evidence, that live feed was turned off. But I was sat in court, as I say, probably 20 feet away from him. We were warned that it would be wrong of us to describe the features of this or give any information that could lead to his identity being known. I think was the phrase used.
You're probably still not to this day allowed to say, for example, what colour hair he has.
Yes, I think it was made very clear to us that we shouldn't give any clues as to identity. It would be understandable, I'm not going to argue with that, to be frank, and it was understandable that we shouldn't want to identify the Chief of Staff of MI5.
The problem here is, though, that there was evidence, enough evidence for them, he said, to have joined the dots. Are you satisfied that enough was done at MI5, the security service, to make sure that this kind of thing could never happen again?
No, I'm not. In fact, it's one of the things that in the period after the inquest, there was a lot of media interest, and I said then, and I still maintain, that we have a very antiquated service. The intelligence community in this country is based on the Cold War. It's not been in any way restructured and reformulated to look at today's threat. It's had a series of sticking plasters put on it. The police service, I think there's 41 or 42 chief constables and separate police forces, each one of which is tasked with its own anti-terrorist activity. And they don't there's no obligation for them to share data, which is what happened in 2005, where Shropshire Police had been watching Sadiq Khan, but they didn't tell anybody else. So they didn't tell MI5, who were also watching him. MI5 didn't tell West Yorkshire Police. The Metropolitan Police were watching him, and they didn't tell the other two, and the other two didn't tell the Metropolitan Police. And that's still the same system today. Now, I've argued this. I had several meetings after the inquest with Theresa May, who was the Home Secretary at the time, in her own office, face-to-face with her, and pointed this out to her, that we had 42 separate police forces, 42 chief constables, each with their own idea of what the terrorist threat is, each with their own... They each decide how much resources they're going to put into it. They each decide how it will be reported, and they each decide on the priority that they assign to anybody they're looking at. On top of that, you've got MI5 looking at the national picture, and they're under no obligation to share data with the police forces. Theresa May's answer was, oh, well, we've now got a police national computer that each of the 42 forces have access to. But they only have access to it if each of the forces say, this is the threshold, we're watching somebody, that person's crossed the threshold, put him or her on the national computer. They could be below the threshold, but known to several forces or several different intelligence services, which would therefore raise the threat, their threat level to a much higher degree, but that's missed. And that's what we saw in Manchester. He was known to the authorities, Abidi, but because he was only known to one and they hadn't shared the information, they didn't realise that this was a much higher threat than he actually was, and that's exactly the same as in 2005. So no, they haven't learnt any lessons.
What would you suggest then? Because we clearly cannot go on with the people in charge at the security services allowing this to happen a third time.
Well, it's not a matter of if, it's a matter of when, was said by the retiring head of MI5 before the Manchester attack. It was said before 2005, which sort of further strengthens my argument that they haven't learnt any lessons. In my view, is we do not need 42 separate police forces looking at this, all with their own different criteria, and then MI5. I think the threat level from ISIS, Daesh, or whatever we call it, is so great and it's so modern in its approach that we need a single dedicated task force or group or whatever we call them, intelligence service, that has a single reporting structure and has a single head who's accountable.
one of the most horrifying things that I've discovered about the 7/7 bombings, in which your son was killed, was the appearance of this chap called Martin McDade up in Leeds, who was an associate of Mohammed Sadiq Khan, the bomber. Martin McDade being a former Special Forces soldier from the Special Boat Service, in day-to-day contact, and even apparently going on little terrorist training missions. Now, what on earth was Special Forces doing in bed with someone who was later to become, allegedly anyway, one of the London bombers?
We've got to be very careful about conspiracy theories here, because the information around this man is very sketchy, and the intelligence community, when I was asking about it after the inquest of 2010, I got nowhere, basically. But you're right, this man has been described by various people who claim to know this to be an inside man, an informer. He was working with MI5 to provide information on an international scale, and somehow missed Sadiq Khan, or misjudged the situation. And he was named in a number of reports and then has since vanished off the face of the earth.
Yeah, it just is a bit worrying, because you've got the secrecy here. It seems his potential here to be used to cover up for dreadful mistakes. In fact, possibly even criminal mistakes that have been made.
Yes, it certainly has a whiff of that, doesn't it? And you are drawn to the conclusion that, like we saw with the environmental activist underground police officers, who would go to any lengths, including criminality, to infiltrate the groups. So you are drawn to the same conclusion, that the same techniques were being used, and that criminal activity may well have been a part of their operational methods, if we can put it that way.
I mean, you've mentioned Manchester, the Manchester attack, Salman Abedie, and the potential as well that they've missed links here, missed clues. It just seems incredible to me that somebody who's potentially quite high up a terrorist watch list can actually get their hands on explosives, possibly get guns, get ammunition. We had the same with the Lee Rigby attacks. I wonder which side of the fence you're sitting on, Graham, whether you think that it's just inevitable that these are going to happen, that you just can't have your eyes and ears everywhere, or whether you think heads should roll. Graham, thanks very much.
Okay.
All right, lovely, thank you.
Was that when they get somebody of interest who they think really is involved in terrorism, they adopt a policy of, let's keep an eye on him, watch and wait, and see who else he takes us to, which is exactly what the police do with criminals, gangland warfare. This is why I keep saying the methodology is old-fashioned. So they were watching Sadiq Khan, because he was involved in the Omar Khayyam bomb, the fertilizer bomb plot, and they believed he also had contacts in Europe, and they were hoping that by letting him run, he would lead them to other people at a higher level, so therefore they would get people higher up the food chain. But we know, don't we, that the terrorists don't operate like that. The individual cells are given autonomy. They're told what to do, they're given some basic training, and then they're kept warm, to use the phrase, and then every now and again they get a message, right, go and do it. They don't maintain regular hierarchical contact with others, yet MI5 and security services believe that they do, and that's why these people are slipping through.
I know you're also involved with I know you're retired with the Prevent strategy. Can you just give us an idea of how that works and if you think it also could maybe be improved on?
Well, I think the big problem with the Prevent strategy is that the way it's been rolled out has led many people, particularly within the Muslim community, to be very wary and frightened of it. And as a result, they're not engaging with it. So if there's somebody within their community they're worried about, they don't think, you know what, I'm going to ring Prevent. And the ones I speak to, they say that, well, we know that what happens is the people that run Prevent are police. It's the police force. And we don't want the police round here. This is the sort of response you get. And there is a great deal in that, because the Prevent strategy is manned at grassroots level by police officers, warrant card carrying police officers. Now, I don't think police officers get out of bed in the morning and think, you know what, I'm going to do a rubbish job today. But they've spent their entire career with the mindset of nicking someone, arresting them and sending them to court. In other words, what you want a good bobby to do. And then you transplant that person after a short training course and say, right, off you go, sunshine. Work with the Muslim community and try and prevent them becoming terrorist bombers. And I just think that is just a nonsense.
How should it be done then?
Well, it's around engaging with the community and empowering the community itself to isolate the people within the community who are not following the rules of that community. And so we have to empower the communities themselves through leadership, through investment, not necessarily financial investment, but investment in our time and effort, and changing the way they interact and engage with the non-Muslim community.
It all seems to be about Muslims, is that right?
Well, I was very hesitant to say that because I thought you might come back at me with that. But we have to be honest, don't we? Every single attack is carried out people who claim that they're doing it because of their Muslim faith.
Some of these attacks have been by the far right, even though the authorities seem to be reluctant to class them as terrorists. I mean, you could be forgiven for saying, well, you could only be a terrorist if you're a Muslim and not if you're a far-right fascist fanatic.
Yeah, and I think that's a valid point that, you know, any Muslim member of the Muslim community, if they make that point, it's very hard to disagree with them, isn't it? I also do some work, through Prevent work is not just with Muslim community, it is with the far-right community when we can engage with them. And I have to say, the far-right community scare me more than the Muslim community or potential terrorists.
Okay, finally, let's just go back to talking about, you know, your 7/7 experience and this more recent experience in Manchester. If you had the ear of Amber Rudd, the Home Secretary, what would you be saying to her, Graham?
I would be urging her as earnestly as I could to abandon the old-fashioned anti-terrorism intelligence system that we have in place, and to come up with a single organisation, single line of accountability and a single focus. Take anti-terrorism away from chief constables. They're simply not equipped to handle it.
Well, that's a very interesting point of view, but it's not one that I share.
I mean, he's saying that actually what's happening with chief constables, there's scores of them everywhere, and of course they're not going to know what the other one's doing.
That may be true, but the real problem, as I'm afraid, I don't necessarily agree with everything that's been said there, is that the intelligence service themselves are actually suspects.
Well, he's also talking about them being accountable, which it would be very difficult for them to be suspected of carrying out terrorist attacks themselves or being complicit if they were accountable.
Well, I wonder if our friend there is aware that of Fernando Imposimato, the head of the Italian Supreme Court.
Martin, we're talking about the British MI5 and the reform of it.
I think MI5 should be abolished, Tony. I think MI6 should be abolished. And I think we need to set up a whole new intelligence service, which we're going to have to recruit a whole lot of new people. But also, when we're dealing with terrorist incidents, whether it's Northern Ireland, Manchester or Bologna, the police, the a civilian police force have to be given the lead role. And that is because, historically, I don't think our friends are aware of this, historically, the intelligence services of the West, including MI5 and MI6, are terrorists. And that's what the Italian police force believe.
He's actually saying that there should maybe be a completely separate anti-terrorist force, which is publicly accountable. But anyway, let's leave that for a moment, because there are loads of other issues there. He's talking about empowering the community. That's what Prevent should be doing. Well, we've actually seen the community have been empowered in the terrorist attacks earlier this year, because most of them, in fact, all of the main people were reported on the anti-terrorist hotline, including people like Kurram Butt and the guy at Westminster, Khalid Massoud, were ejected from their own mosques.
Yes, indeed. And of course, I'm going to go a stage further than he has gone. I have to suggest that the intelligence services, there are two ways in which you can analyse this. They either make it happen on purpose, MIHOP, or they let it happen on purpose, LIHOP.
OK, let's go back to 7-7 again and look at this chap, Martin McDade, MI5 infiltrator training, Mohammed Siddiqui Khan, one of the main bombers over in Cumbria.
Yes, in other words, this guy, as an ex-Special Forces guy, was training them in Special Forces techniques. So he wasn't just infiltrating the group to get information, was he?
But he's vanished.
Yeah. Fascinating, eh? And I think that's what Sherlock Holmes would call a clue. And I think it should be the police who investigate these things independently of the intelligence services. And what they've got to bear in mind, as the police service in Northern Ireland do, is that the intelligence service may well be involved. And that's one of the things you've got to consider as an investigating police officer.
You're in a situation of the police, quite often, I imagine, where you've got the intelligence services breathing down your neck and saying, actually, we're taking over here.
Well, that's exactly right, and that's what's happened in Italy. But, of course, the Italian police force, working through the magistrate, uncovered the fact that SISMI was behind the terrorism. Okay. In other words, it was being orchestrated from within the state.
Let's go back to the Manchester attacks from May. And one of the most interesting interviewees, which appeared on Sky TV, was a woman called Kirsten Pollard, who was in the audience at that event at the music concert with Ariana Grande. And she, I wonder maybe if the Manchester police have spoken to her, because here's her interview now she did with Sky News.
We sat down in our seats to start from the beginning. We had somebody sat next to us and looked very suspicious. She was fidgeting all the time with a bag on the floor across her. She was by herself.
What was she doing?
She was looking in the direction of where the explosion actually happened all night and smirking to herself. I got suspicious myself, and my friend said to me, who was actually sat next to her, directly next to her, said, "I don't like this." She was fidgeting with her bag and the zips and on and off, hands in the pockets. It puts you on edge.
What did you do about it?
I told security, who then informed a higher security. They were up and down the stairs where she was sat discreetly, watching her. I knew what they were doing. Nothing was actually done about it. And then later on, as the concert was going and Ariana actually came on the stage, she was getting more and more agitated. The bag was then on the floor, and I actually sat next to her and I actually nudged her arm intentionally so I could actually speak to her. I said, "Oh, sorry about that. Are you by yourself?" And she said, "Yes," and she spoke to me, but I didn't understand her.
You were worried enough to talk to security.
Yes,
they listened to you, although you say that they didn't really do anything.
I don't think security did listen to me.
Then what happened?
Because then my daughter got very upset about things, Holly, and she went to security, and they basically told her, "How would you like it if someone accused you of this? We'll look into it." And nothing was done about it.
And then, of course,
the concert went on. This lady was more agitated. 1 to 2 minutes before the concert finished, this lady disappeared. And then, of course, the explosion went off in the other end of the stadium.
And what can you remember of that? What did you see?
It was just a huge boom. I never saw no smoke, no flashes or anything. They were trying to blame the balloons, because there were some large helium balloons, but the boom was too big. It was too big. It couldn't have been a speaker, because the music had finished. Ariana, she'd gone off the stage, so then everyone started screaming and just charged to the nearest exit. Up the stairs, it was a stampede, it was absolutely horrendous. People were pushing me, we were just running, and fortunately our hotel is just 5 minutes away, so we ran and got into the hotel. but it was just absolutely horrendous, and the security was awful. I'm sorry to say that the security did nothing about it, and there should have been more security. And we walked through the doors when we, you know, we had our tickets, and they scan your tickets, and we wasn't even checked. They never checked bags at all. I never saw them check anybody's
bags. What's most
bags.
Interesting about this lady is that she wasn't interviewed by the police at the end of afterwards. And that begins to, you begin to ask the question, well, why not? Surely you'd interview that person. Now, I'll repeat what I said earlier. There is historical evidence that NATO intelligence services...
We haven't got time for you to go repeating things, Martin, OK? So what about this whole concept of MI5 making money from terrorism?
Well, one of the reasons behind this kind of strategies of tension is to aggrandise power to the secret state. So the secret state runs the terrorists. That's what they were doing in Italy, according to the Italian police, for 20 or 30 years. Lots of people were killed, more people than in Manchester and Bologna. And, of course, the secret state then says, we need more resources to catch the terrorists, even though in fact they are the terrorists. And that is what the Italian police, after 30 years of investigation, firmly drew the conclusion. And Imposimato, who's the head of the Italian Supreme Court, wrote a book about it in 2012, La Repubblica dei Stragi Impuni, The Republic of the Unpunished Massacres. And of course, Al-Qaeda was set up by the Western intelligence services. That's what Sherlock Holmes would immediately say. Hang on a minute, who set these people up? We did. Now, at what point did we lose control of our own structure that we created with our tax money to fight the Russians in Afghanistan? The Russian general staff think that we're still running that structure.
Getting bigger by being better. The number one choice for Bristol. This is BCFM 93.2.
Also, very strange going on over in Saudi Arabia this week, Martin.
Yes, there's been some kind of internal Game of Thrones battle between MBS and his internal enemies. Rafiq Hariri, the president of Lebanon, appears in Saudi Arabia and then resigns on Saudi TV because he's a dual Saudi-Lebanese national. Thierry Meyssan is suggesting that in actual fact he's not the son of Rafiq Hariri, he's the son of a Saudi prince.
Is Crown Prince Mohammed bin Salman, is that who? Is MBS?
MBS, as he's called, yes.
So, what about the idea of forcing him to resign on TV?
Well, there's it was suggested by Michel Aoun, who's the president, who's a Christian president of Lebanon, and also by Hassan Nasrallah from Hezbollah, that Rafiq Hariri was under some kind of constraint. Now, Rafiq Hariri, in fact, owes loads of money to the Saudi government. We're talking billions, so it may be that he's told what to do because he owes them loads of money and he's got to do what they say. It may be that he's in cahoots with the Saudis, because of course what's happened in Lebanon, because at the end of the civil war, there is a rule in Lebanon, the president has to be a Christian, the prime minister has to be a Sunni Muslim, and the speaker of the parliament has to be a Shia Muslim. That's the rules in Lebanon. So what we've had a relatively stable situation in Lebanon for the last few years, because there's been an agreement to share power between the various communities that make up the Lebanese mosaic, as it were. But Rafiq Hariri going off to Saudi Arabia and then denouncing the government that he used to be in is possibly a prelude to a war led by Israel and Saudi Arabia against Iran, in which will be fought in Lebanon, and which of course will drag in Trump, because Trump's behind. They've not done any of this without agreeing it with Trump's people.
What do you make of the shot across the bows of RT America? They're saying now that they've got to register as some sort of a foreign hostile force in Washington.
Well, it's never been used against journalists before. It's always been used against lobbyists, but it's a bit laughable.
Against who?
Well, if you are a foreign lobbyist, in theory, you've got to register. But, of course, the Israelis and the Saudis spend loads of money trying to lobby the US Congress, but they don't have to register at all.
Are RT lobbying Congress?
No, they're just a journalist organisation. So, in other words, they're just trying to shut them up. But, of course, you can do that, but you end up with the band in Boston syndrome. When you tell people not to listen to things, do you know what happens? They go out and listen to those things, because what they're doing is saying RT is hurting. RT is telling us things we don't want to hear, so we're going to try and shut it down. And anybody who's got any sense of, well, that's RT that I want to hear about.
I mean, isn't this what mad despots do? They try and shut up people they don't want to hear.
Well, that's right. But, of course, they also try and pretend that this is a society of freedom of speech, etc. And in Russia, people aren't allowed to say what they like. In actual fact, in Russia, people are allowed to say what they like, and in the US, they're not. And that's an ideological struggle which they're going to lose if that's the road they go down.
We mentioned, obviously, we had an interview with Graham Fawkes earlier on. One of the things which I should have mentioned then, really, was that he had his phone hacked as part of the phone hacking scandal as well, which filled him with horror, he said at the time. One does wonder, since he was one of the leaders of the victims' families' groups, that they were specifically targeting him for that reason.
Quite possibly, and then it raises the interesting question, what's the links between Murdoch's private security organisation and the public security organisation with its links to Al-Qaeda going back to the 1980s?
Also, how Harvey Weinstein used Mossad agents to try and shut down his accusers. Now, this was in the Daily Beast and other papers. Apparently, Harvey Weinstein was actually employed former people who'd been trained by the Israeli Secret Service, the Mossad, who every time he got accused by somebody, they would then go to work on those accusers to try and shut them down.
Well, it's a very good question. When somebody's worked for something like Mossad or MI6 and then they go into their own private business, are they still working for the Mossad or not? And in actual fact, most of these security agents have become subcontracted out massively. So the CIA is no longer a straightforward organisation. There are hundreds of bits of it, all of which are subcontracted.
I shouldn't mention the Daily Beast, really, because the report originally was from the New Yorker. Former Mossad agents hired by Harvey Weinstein posed as women's rights advocates and secretly recorded meetings with the actress Rose McGowan as part of a wide-ranging attempt by the movie mogul to shut down the investigation. So this is the attempt to sort of play both sides of the chessboard. It's almost like setting up a little counter gang, saying, well, actually, we don't like people like Harvey Weinstein either. Come and have a chat with us. And actually, they're working for him.
Well, that's right. And, of course, the linkage between the private power that he exercises and the power of the Israeli state and the power of the secret state in the US and here, there's a massive overlap. It's a revolving door, isn't it?
Until this story was proven, I suppose that would have been called a conspiracy theory.
Indeed.
In the report for the New Yorker, Ronan Farrow, the journalist who was among the first to expose Harvey Weinstein, records in compelling detail the meticulous manner in which Weinstein sought to suppress allegations he'd sexually harassed or assaulted numerous women. This is a pretty sophisticated operation, and of course, Weinstein is not the only one up to this.
No, and of course, it's quite possible that the VIP feed file scandal in Britain is because the intelligence services, MI5 and MI6, have been using paedophilia as a means of political blackmail for years. That's what the Kinkora Boys Home scandal is all about in Northern Ireland, which is what Ken Livingstone used his maiden speech in the Commons to expose many years ago. But it's still running, the sore is still open. MI5 were definitely using the Kinkora Boys Home as a honey trap, prostituting underage boys to politicians in order to blackmail them. And the suggestion is it wasn't just going on there.
Well, what do you make of this claim also, which was being reported by BBC World Service, about $5.6 billion being the cost so far of the war on terror?
Well, it's hard to know exactly how much, but it sounds like a credible figure to me. Just think of the amount of money that's been spent. And that's one of the reasons why we're in this strategy of tension. Because the more bombs go off, the more people get scared, the more they're prepared to give the state resources to try and catch the perpetrators. And the secret state by steps becomes a police state, which is actually running the terrorists. And that would be my fundamental contention.
So why don't we see that hypothesis put forward on our mainstream press at all?
Because the mainstream press is either working for the government directly or indirectly, like the BBC, or they're run by people like Murdoch, who are very, very close to the Israeli secret state, for
example.
And what's
been the effect on the economy of this kind of spending? I mean, that's 5.6. Just let me remind you, folks. It's not 5.6 billion. It's 5.6 trillion.
Trillion.
Yeah. 5.6 trillion. So what's been the effect on the Western
economy?
Well, what
it does is it...
I mean, compare it to something like the Second World War or the First World War, Martin.
Well, it's probably on a level in terms of expenditure, but what it does is distorts the society so that instead of producing a better widget for the working housewife, energy gets people's skills and resources are basically given to making weapons of death, which deal in death, as we're seeing in Yemen this week, where potentially the biggest famine since World War II, entirely human created, and we are involved because the RAF are in Saudi Arabia helping the Saudis to win the war against Yemen. Do people realise that we're at war with Yemen? Maybe somebody from Yemen might come along and kill some of our soldiers at some point.
Another amazing story this week. Italian mafia and ISIS have been collaborating to traffic drugs. Millions of opioid tablets were seized, bound for Libya. This is the Italian police seizing more than 24 million opioid tablets destined for ISIS militants. A local prosecutor believes the case may be connected to the 50 million euro drug deal.
Well, we just don't know all the detail about this, do we? When they say something's connected to ISIS, and we know that ISIS is effectively run by the Saudi secret services or in alliance with our secret services.
How come the mafia can operate so with impunity over there?
Well, the mafia were also involved in Operation Gladio back in the 70s and 80s.
Let me tell you as well, the mafia were also the main operators behind bringing people across the Mediterranean as well, making money not only from the poor people who were trying to get to Europe, but also from the running those camps over in Italy.
Well, there's a very interesting book by Alfred McCoy called The CIA and Drugs. The intelligence agencies, including MI6, have been involved in the drugs industry from the get-go, which means that they actually have counterparts in the mafia who work with them, like Colonel Oliver Stone, who helped Alfredo Calero from the Contras to bring massive amounts of cocaine into the United States, all with a nod and a wink from the CIA.
Well, let's have a listen now to this commentator. His name's Jean-Pierre de Smet. He's from South Africa, talking about Albert Pike. Now, I know you don't give Albert Pike any credence, Martin, but a lot of people do. And Albert Pike was a general in the Confederate Army. In 1875, he wrote a letter to Mazzini, who was involved in solidifying Italy as one single country, saying that they should plan three great world wars. Well, we've had two of them. Let's have a listen and we'll hear a bit more next week from Jean-Pierre de Smet.
Now, Albert Pike wrote a letter to Mazzini, and that was dated August 15, 1871, in which he propagated that there should be a world order, a one order where all nations are under the control of one central organization. And in order to achieve this, they plan the First World War, to overthrow the power of the Tsars in Russia, protector of orthodoxy, and bring about an atheistic communistic state. Did that happen? The Second World War, that's also written long before the event, to originate between Great Britain and Germany, to strengthen communism as antithesis to the Judeo-Christian culture, and bring about a Zionist state in Israel. Did it achieve this objective? Yes? In fact, after this war, Israel, in its present form, was reinstated under the protection of Britain. And then, interestingly enough, a third world war, a Middle Eastern war involving Judaism and Islam and spreading internationally. Well, here's another quote, just in case people don't like that quote. Mazzini with Pike developed a plan for three world wars so that eventually every nation would be willing to surrender its national sovereignty to a world government. The first war was to end the Tsarist regime in Russia, the second to allow the Soviet Union to control Europe, the third world war was to be in the Middle East between Muslim and Jews and would result in Armageddon. Interesting.
So that's Jean-Pierre de Smet. We'll have another clip from him, final clip next week. Time to sign off now for the Murdoch News at 7. Coming up live on Facebook is Arabian Nights with Mohammed Makawi. Thanks for our guests in the first hour. That was both of them was Conservative Group Bristol City Council leader Mark Weston and former teacher, founder member of Counter Colston, Christine Townsend. Thanks also to Old Labour Oxford economist Martin Summers. This show's story links and comment page is thisweek.org.uk. You'll find me on Twitter at Tony Gosling. Here's wishing you a relaxing and enjoyable BCFM weekend. I'll leave you with music. This time it's right. We didn't get it right last week. We are this week, hopefully. That's from 2001. It's Sophie Ellis-Bextor. Do please join us for the politics show at the same time next week. God bless and don't let the banksters get you down. Gonna burn this nice old house right down. 4, 3, 2, 1. Oh, no.
Bristol's BCFM on 93.2, online and on your mobile. BCFM is an award-winning community radio station for Bristol, bringing you national news on the hour. Live from the Sky News Centre.